Rick Britton joins me live in studio. He is a local celebrated and award-winning author, cartographer, historian, and he joins us once a week as we explore the top 25 most significant Civil War battles that took place here in Virginia. And Rick, we have been spending many weeks now exploring this list. We started with First Manassas, yeah. And we are now on number 19
number
of 25.
19. It's almost taken as long as the war.
This is the Battle of the Crater, which took place in the summer of 1864.
Right.
Part of the final act of closing the war down, when you start to see the success of Grant's overland campaign.
That's right.
Through central Virginia. Now, before we do that, though, let's refresh folks and give them an update about the speaker series you have and the classes you have at the senior center.
At the senior center, yeah. We've got the last talk in our Civil War lecture and day trip series for 2010. And on Wednesday, October 20th, so that's a week from today, Ron Wilson, who was the historian at Appomattox National Battlefield Park, a beautiful site down there. For 25 years, this guy was the historian. He's going to talk on John Brown's Harper's Ferry raid in 1859. And then
interesting.
It's a fascinating
topic. Why that's never been a big Hollywood movie, I don't know, because it's got Hollywood movie written all over it.
Oh, it sure does.
Doesn't it?
Well, but
it's incredibly dramatic, and the guy was just larger than life.
He was super larger than life. It actually has been the subject of a number of movies. I mean, I've seen some people, I'm trying to remember the actor.
But they're older movies, aren't they?
I can see him, yeah. It was done in the 30s or the early 40s, and it was really, really well done. From the African-American point of view, it has a very bad ending. So perhaps that's the reason it hasn't been done. It's a pretty sad ending, and it helps spark the war. It's got some amazing characters. Brown himself, and then, of course, Robert E. Lee and Jeb Stuart.
We're all involved.
And Stonewall Jackson was there for the hanging before he was Stonewall.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's going to talk about John Brown's 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry. And then the very next week, so 2 weeks from today, October 27th, we're taking a trip to Harper's Ferry, and if you haven't been, it's just absolutely beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful places on the East Coast to have a city. It's just so dramatic.
It's like a movie set.
The geography there is just so dramatic. You know, Jefferson wrote about it himself, and we'll climb up to Jefferson's Rock, and you can see the view that Jefferson wrote about, how the two rivers, the Potomac and the Shenandoah, come together, and it looks like you can just tell that they've cut their way through the mountains right there at Harper's Ferry.
Yeah,
it's just really fantastic.
Yeah. Hey, this guy coming up from Appomattox, I've never been to Appomattox. For those of us who've never been,
you should really go.
What is it you actually see there?
What they've done is they've restored this little town that was the seat for Appomattox County. And so you go in there, and there's, of course, a great museum about the surrender and the McLean House, where the actual surrender took place. Those are there, but they've restored a number of the buildings. Several dozen of the buildings. So you go into this little place, and it's this restored piece of history. It's just fantastic.
Like a little Williamsburg, but from the Civil War.
Right. It's just beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Last time I was there, it was on one of these fall days when it's just great to be alive, you know, with this big sky blue view, and we were there, and it was just absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, it's a must-see place in Virginia.
Now, what's the number for the senior center again, so folks can get
at
the information?
At the senior center, yeah, and his talk, by the way, a week from today on October 20th is absolutely free, so just come. It's 974-6538.
We're talking with Rick Britton at about 20 minutes in front of 5 o'clock on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon. It's 71 degrees in Charlottesville. They say there's some rain in the forecast for tonight and tomorrow. We'll have a full details on that weather report for you at the top of the hour. So, Rick, take us back now to the summer of 1864. We're right on the heels of the most recent battles that we have talked about, Cold Harbor, Trevilian Station,
Trevilian
New Market.
Station, right. So now the Army of the Potomac under Grant's immediate direction and George Gordon Meade, they're investing. They've put Petersburg under siege and Richmond. So we're in the month of June, and the Confederate lines are encircling Richmond. Richmond and Petersburg. There's a half circle of Confederate fortifications around to the south of Petersburg, and just about in the middle of that is a place called, a little fort called Elliott's Salient, and it was manned by a battery of Confederate artillery and a number of infantrymen, and it was on a little rise, a little prominence there, is typically where you emplace artillery, and less than 200 yards away was the Federal earthworks. So right at this place, facing Elliott's Salient, was a Pennsylvania regiment led by a colonel by the name of Pleasants, who had been a mining engineer in Pennsylvania. And so he came up with this idea, which, you know, a lot of people think was new to the Civil War, but it wasn't. It goes all the way back to the beginning of warfare, to the Greeks and the Romans, and even earlier, probably. The idea was to mine, to dig a mine, a shaft, all the way underneath this Confederate fort, pack it with black powder, and blow it up, and then charge through the hole in the Confederate lines. So this idea goes all the way up to Meade and Grant, and they approve it, but kind of half-heartedly. Grant and Meade are never entirely behind this plan. So
it's not like anything else that we've seen so far.
Well, no, actually, the year before at Vicksburg, there was also a mine that was also a failure, like this one. Ultimately fails, this idea and this attack. The idea succeeds, the attack fails. So Pleasant's men happen to also be largely miners from western Pennsylvania. So he puts them to work. So they dig a shaft, they dig a mine. Now, to get the size of this thing, a man would have to crouch over to walk through this. So it's not a huge, tall thing. But they dig one 511 feet. Connecting them with the area beneath Elliott's Salient, beneath this fort, 20 feet down. And Pleasants comes up with all kinds of really interesting ideas. They figured out how to draw fresh air into it. The way they did that was, if you can imagine, to get down, first you have to go down into the shaft, and then the shaft runs horizontally under the Confederate fort. At the bottom of the initial shaft, they built a large fire. And then all the way at the base, all the way along the base of this mine, this shaft, they put in a wooden tube that was open at the other end. So by having a fire near the Federal side of this tube, the fire draws the air out and then draws the air all the way down this tube from the head of the shaft, thereby causing fresh air to rush in. So that way he ensured that the men at the head of this mining operation always had fresh air. So it's a fascinating idea. So they did all kinds of stuff
like
this.
And all of this sort of fits into a picture. We're talking with Rick Britton. This sort of fits into the picture of the Federals are trying to figure out how to get in.
How to get through to Petersburg.
Petersburg and Richmond.
Petersburg. If Petersburg falls, they know that Richmond has to fall. Robert E. Lee has to defend both Petersburg and Richmond. Petersburg is the gateway to Richmond. A lot of the railroads that go into Richmond come via Petersburg on the south side of the Appomattox. Lee has to hold on to Petersburg. It's almost impossible to hold on to Richmond if he loses Petersburg. So Lee has to defend Petersburg. So they're trying to get into Petersburg. It takes them about a month. It takes them 23 days. They dig 511 feet to a point 20 feet beneath the Confederate battery, that fort.
And clearly the Confederates knew this was going on.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the things I've learned from you is how much they sort of knew what the other side was doing.
And so they had their countermines going on. They're digging down, trying to reach them, and then they would drop in some grenades or drop in some powder and blow up that end of the mine. Yeah, their countermining operations going on because toward the very end, they can hear them. They're only 20 feet underground. They can actually hear them, but they can't get at them. So the Federals pack 8,000 pounds of black powder directly beneath this Confederate fort. And I have the exact figure here. It's 320 kegs of black powder, 8,000 pounds, 4 tons of black powder. And the thing was set to go off at 3:30 a.m. on July 30th, 1864. Now, The man in charge of this portion of the federal lines, unfortunately, was Burnside. The same Burnside who failed at Fredericksburg, the same Burnside who failed in the famous Mud March. We didn't talk about that, but it's another debacle in his military career. There were plenty of other debacles. He did very, very poorly at the Wilderness. He did very badly at Spotsylvania also. So he is already at the kind of the bottom of the list. He's the corps commander here. He picks a African-American division to lead the assault. And he's all excited about this. They plan. They make special preparations as to how to leave the federal trenches and make that attack across into the hole that's going to be created by this huge explosion. At the very last moment, Grant and Meade intercede. And they say, wait a minute. If this thing is a huge failure and we throw these African-Americans into this attack, it's going to look to everybody that we're throwing them into the slaughter just to get rid of them. We can't have a black division lead this assault. And so they tell Burnside to pick another unit, not a black division, to lead this assault. So stupidly, Burnside has his division commanders draw lots to do this, to be the lead division, to go into this hole created by this explosion. And the worst division commander he has, a guy by the name of Ledlie, draws the right to lead his division in. Ledlie never even witnesses the attack. Ledlie hides in a bombproof, sending messages to the front, and never even, later on he was court-martialed. Ledlie never even witnesses the attack of his own men. Also, this division, Ledlie's division, hadn't gone through any of the drills. None of the preparations were made by these guys. So now all of a sudden these guys are in the lead. The time comes. They light the fuse at 3:30 a.m. on July 30th.
How far back are they? Does the fuse like go down into the...
They're 200 yards away. That fuse has to go all that 511 feet, almost 200 yards. That has to
through
go
the,
that,
through the mine. Through
the mine to
the
get
tunnel
to
that
those
they
8,000 pounds to blow that up. So they wait.
And the Confederates don't know that this is the night.
They have no idea. Right. Okay. Just pre-dawn.
They know they've been digging.
They know they've been
digging. They know they want to put...
They know all of a sudden it's kind of quiet, so it seems kind of ominous, right?
Yeah.
All right. So they wait, and they wait, and they wait, and nothing happens. The fuse at a place where there was a splice, it went out. So two of the guys from that Pennsylvania unit, imagine this, they volunteered to go into the mine to relight the fuse. Can you imagine that kind of courage? You know, what idiot would courage and idiocy to volunteer to go back into that mine knowing that there's 8,000 pounds of powder at the other end. But two guys did it, and they found that at a splice it had gone out. So they relit it, ran the heck out, and at 4:45, this thing exploded. And there's this huge explosion like nobody has ever seen. A huge, almost like a mushroom cloud, goes up into the air.
This has to be one of the biggest explosions in the history of this country up until that point.
Possibly is, yeah. We'd have to think about that, yeah, but possibly is, absolutely.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, this is one of the biggest in the Civil War, right?
We'd have to compare it to the one, and I don't know how big, how much powder was in the one used a year earlier, almost exactly a year earlier, at Vicksburg. So we'd have to compare that.
Yeah.
That one might actually be larger. I don't remember. So it goes off, and, you know, you could see pieces of artillery pieces and men in the air and pieces of men in the air. Something like 278 Confederates were either killed or wounded in this explosion. The men in and around this salient. And it created a crater, and therein the name, the crater.
And this is known as the Battle of the Crater. Yeah.
Right. 170 feet long, 60 to 80 feet wide, and 30 feet deep. It created this huge hole where just a moment before, there had been this fort, Elliott's Salient, on the top of this hill. Now remember, it creates a hole in the Confederate lines, but there's still Confederate lines on either side. And they have traverses, and the traverses are perpendicular trenches that run to the rear, just in case something like this happens. So here comes this division under Ledlie, and they charge across, and naturally, what do? You know, when they get to this hole, they pile into the hole, right? And the trenches on either side. And Burnside's idea, and it was a typical federal idea at the time, is just keep piling in more men and eventually we'll bust in. Well, they keep piling in more men and more men, and eventually three divisions, and then eventually the black division also gets piled in, so that there are 15,000 men in and around this crater.
Oh my God.
By the end of the attack, Federals, just Federals, with about 11, 12,000 Confederates defending. Well, here's what happened. They piled into this hole, and very few of them had the idea of, you know, we've got to penetrate deeper into the Confederate lines to really make this breakthrough work. We have to penetrate deeper, like we talked about at the Mule Shoot. You have to go deeper into their lines, and then you have to open up the lines on either flank and make this hole bigger. Well, that was very difficult, and the Confederates reacted admirably. There's a rise just behind where the crater was in the Confederate lines, and they emplaced a lot of artillery there. They brought up mortars. Mortars are pieces of artillery that lob the shells up into the air and drop down into earthworks, into trenches, into positions like the crater. So the Confederates show up and surround this position and then start lobbing artillery shells.
Down into the hole.
Down into this hole. And so the slaughter was really horrific at the crater. So it turns into this.
So the Federals open a hole, literally, in the Confederate lines.
And then pile into
the
hole.
And then pile in thousands of men into it. And then the Confederates shoot down on them.
Right. And it's almost like fish in a barrel. Now, there's another aspect we need to talk about, because we can't talk about the crater. And the reason this is important is because of the participation of the African-American troops. They had been in the war for a while. They hadn't really been in combat here in Virginia on a large scale like this. Had they been in action before? A little bit. Had they seen action on this kind of scale? Not really. So a lot of the Confederate soldiers were angered over the participation of African Americans in the federal war effort. Men who, lots of them, had only recently been enslaved African Americans. And so some of the counterattacks that the Confederates threw against that mob in the crater became, because of that anger, particularly vicious. And a lot of the African Americans were slaughtered needlessly. And some probably tried to surrender and were killed after they attempted to surrender. So this became a huge slaughter in the crater, so much so that eventually, out of all those men who participated, almost 4,000 of the Federals were killed, wounded, or captured, compared to only about 1,500 Confederates.
Wow.
So
it's a Confederate victory.
It is a Confederate victory. Yeah. Great idea. It actually worked. It blew a big hole, but it was very short-sighted in how it was planned and how it was prosecuted, how it was carried through, this plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking with Rick Britton. He joins us every week to explore the top 25 most significant battles that took place here in Virginia during the United States Civil War. And I'm looking at our list here. This appears to be the last significant Confederate victory on your list.
It is.
I mean, from here on out, we see the Union troops take the lead.
Yeah, again and again and again. And in the very next one, we're going to talk about one that I put on the list, the Battle of Chaffin's Farm, that's also on the list because of the African-American participation. And in this one, we're going to talk about next week, but that one was also very interesting. Battle of the Crater, really famous. And unfortunately, afterwards, they built a golf course there. So the crater became that, you know, real easy, you know, hole 18. Right.
So there's a golf course where the crater is today?
There was a golf course built in the early 20th century over the crater. So there's really very little left there. It's very disappointing. It's one of those sites. It's one of those Civil War sites you go to that's awfully disappointing when you get to see it.
Yeah, because that hole is, does it still
exist? Very little. No, there's hardly anything left. It's just a depression. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's very hard to envision once you get there.
So real quick, we got like a minute left. What happens afterwards? They regroup the Confederates.
Counterattack and regain their lines. And
they hold on to Petersburg.
And they hold on to Petersburg for a little while yet. Yeah.
But this takes us now, we're getting into the fall of 1864. This war ended in the spring of 1865.
Right.
They don't really fight in the wintertime. So we're really seeing this is the beginning of the end now.
It is the beginning of the end. And some of the things that we're going to talk about over the next few episodes is how the election of 1864 became important and what the victories on the battlefield did for Abraham Lincoln's candidacy.
Yeah, because he's going into a re-election campaign, so he needs some victories out there.
He really does need some battlefield victories.
Interesting. Yeah. Rick, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Rick's online at rickbritton.com, and you can listen to the archived conversations we've had about the top 25 most important Civil War battles in Virginia online at wina.com.